Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Baghdad, September 2004. Wall Street Journal reporter Farnaz Fasihi sends an email to friends. She writes, "Being a foreign correspondent in Baghdad these days is like being under virtual house arrest." Saddam had been out of power for more than a year, and the dancing in the streets of Baghdad had turned to chaos. There was a daily diet of looting, car bombs, kidnapping, and a dangerous struggle just to stay alive. This hour on Point, Farnaz Fasihi and her new book about everyday Iraqis living and struggling with war. You can join the conversation. Do we know enough about how the U.S.-led invasion has affected ordinary Iraqis? What stories from Iraq affected you the most? And joining me now from Stanford, California, is Farnaz Fasihi. She is the Wall Street Journal Deputy Bureau Chief for the Middle East and Africa, now based in Beirut, Lebanon. She was stationed in Baghdad from the beginning of the war in 2003 to December 2005. And her new book, a look back at her time in Iraq and a memoir of sorts, is called Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. And Farnaz Fasihi, great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming in.
Hello, Anthony. It's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
Well, your book, very powerful, and thank you for that. And let's start with why you wrote this book. You say early on that it was a bit of a catharsis for you. How so?
Well, it was difficult to revisit all the memories of Iraq and, process it in a way and read through notebooks and, remember what it was like and really how life had gone for several characters that the book follows. So in a way, it was a therapeutic experience for me to remember everything and to be able to put it down in paper. But, the thing that struck me after leaving Iraq and every time I would come home from Iraq was how little people really knew about what life was there like for, Iraqi people. There's a lot of public discourse here about the American troops in Iraq or the policy surrounding the Iraq war, but very little about how the war had impacted the lives of ordinary people. Mm. So I thought I would document what I had seen.
Indeed. What separates this book from a lot of the reporting on the war is how it follows the life of those normal people. Let's talk about some of them.
Sure.
Tell me about the Nassers. They were originally... Let me just start there. Tell me about the family, the Nassers. You came to know them. They were very worried about the invasion at the beginning. They were originally optimistic, but then things quickly went south for them.
The Nassers are a great example of just middle-class educated Iraqis who were uneasy about the war, didn't support the war, but didn't like Saddam. And when the war happened, they were willing to give the American enterprise a chance and thought perhaps Iraq is going to open up, there will be money coming in, job opportunities, an opportunity to connect to the rest of the world, and things will slowly get better. The Nassers are a middle-class, well-educated Iraqi family, Christian Iraqi family, that I met in October 2002 when I first went to Baghdad and Saddam Hussein was still in power. They invited me into their home, which was very unusual for Iraqis at that point, and I got to spend some time with them back then and then followed them, found them again after the war and made a tradition to have lunch with them every week, so really got to know them very intimately and followed their lives. I think by mid-2004, you can say that their enthusiasm started evaporating. Mm. They were hopeful. The senior Nasser, Sabah Nasser, had opened up a paint shop because he thought there's going to be a lot of reconstruction in Iraq, there are going to be a lot of foreign companies coming in to set shop, and he could possibly make money. And he handed me 100 business cards asking me if I could hand them out to my foreign associates, But by the end of 2004, his business was bankrupt because reconstruction had stagnated because of security issues, and American and foreign companies were very reluctant in hiring Iraqis because of the insurgency, because a lot of Iraqis were informing informants for the insurgency. So, life slowly fell apart for the Nassers. And by the time civil war started affecting Iraq in 2006, they had to actually relocate from their neighborhood in Adamiya, which is predominantly Sunni, to a all-Christian neighborhood in Baghdad, where they still are. They haven't returned to their home.
Mm. And a couple of them, was it Ayad and Asil Nasser, left Iraq 18 months ago and had to flee to Jordan.
Exactly. Mm. Ayad received a death threat because he was working as a computer engineer for the Iraqi Ministry of Defense, which is mostly Shia, he decided to leave. He fled Iraq, and he's living in Jordan now with his wife and two children. They've registered with the UNHCR as refugees, but their application has not been accepted yet because there are about 2.5 million Iraqi refugees in neighboring Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon, mm. and their numbers are far greater than the slots available in host countries.
And you did a follow-up piece for the Wall Street Journal on them. They're tight on money, living in limbo.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I guess this is a pretty typical story for a lot of people who, you know, maybe had one feeling about this war at one point, but, you know, once they were confronted with the reality, felt very differently about it.
I mean, that's the thing, Anthony. You know, I mean, I think that war destroys everything it touches. You know, it really affects people individually, every house, every family. You can't, you know, just say wars or invading a country or, you know, it's going to benefit anybody particularly. You know, there's a lot of damage and mayhem that comes with it.
Mm. And I was struck by so many details in the book where, you know, you weren't talking about big policy debates. I mean, there was that too, but what struck me the most were just these characters in your book dealing with the huge challenges of just trying to live day to day. And
right.
I'm thinking, for example, about Omar Juma, whose home
yes.
was actually inside the U.S.-controlled green zone, which at first blush might sound like, oh, that's probably lucky for him because it's safe. But of course, it creates huge challenges for him, right?
Absolutely. You know, the Green Zone houses about 10,000 Iraqis because it's, if you imagine, say, New York, and you think, you know, if somebody would put a wall around Midtown Manhattan and set up a base in there, naturally the homes that fell inside of that place would be within that security zone. And the Green Zone isn't really safe because it's constantly under attack of mortars and barrages of rockets that hit the Green Zone. And also the checkpoints are common targets of car bombs and, you know, shootouts. So it's not particularly safe for the Iraqis who are living there, but they just happen to be there. And, you know, the Americans have issued ID cards for the Iraqis who live there. They have to enter from checkpoints. They're not allowed to bring in outside guests, maybe one at a time. And for Omar, who was a young, you know, married man with a child, I remember they were trying to celebrate their son's first birthday, and they couldn't invite more than two people. So they had to arrange for it to be at a relative's home outside of the Green Zone. And every day that he went to work, it would take commonly between an hour to 6 hours of sitting at the checkpoint to come in and out. So he had a bicycle in the trunk of his car. And sometimes when the checkpoint was too bad, he would just park the car and try to ride his bike in and out, you know, or walk.
Mm. And you write about the emotional toll of the constant stress of this war. And one
right.
of the results you write is that Iraqis pop antidepressants, anti-anxiety, and sleeping pills
right.
like candy. And you spoke to doctors in Iraq. Tell us how they describe what's going on in this regard.
Well, you know, what the doctors, the psychiatrist that I spoke to, was saying that, you know, he even has patients coming in with guns asking him for anti-anxiety and sleeping pills. That most of these patients are just addicted to these stuff. And, you know, one of the things that struck me that I remember was that, you know, the stress and the anxiety that Iraqis have been exposed to from living under Saddam, living under tyranny, to living under chaos and occupation, slowly, you know, it rips the capability to be able to decide independently and for yourself, or just living in constant fear that something can happen any minute. You know, it just, you can't decide for the future. You can't really plan your life because you don't really know if you're going to be alive tomorrow or not. One of the things that I remember my driver, Munaf, used to always say every day was that, you know, every night when I sleep, I have to thank God that nobody in my family is dead or injured.
Farnaz Fasihi, you left in December 2005. Have you been curious to return?
That's a good question. I have been curious to return, but I haven't returned yet. Maybe I will return if things get a little bit more stable and safe. You know, it took about a little over a year to finish the book, and I thought it was a kind of, I came full circle with writing the book and kind of laying the memories to rest and moving on.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about how life has changed for everyday Iraqis. You can join the conversation. What's your question about life in Iraq post-Saddam and post-U.S. invasion? I'm joined by The Wall Street Journal's Deputy Bureau Chief for the Middle East and Africa, Farnaz Fasihi. She covered the Iraq War from the U.S. invasion until late 2005. She's also author of the new book, Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. And Farnaz, I want to talk to you about this famous email that you sent in 2004, which I gather sort of inspired the spirit of the book. You sent it to family and friends, and you talked very bluntly about how dire the situation was on the ground in Baghdad. The email was picked up on the internet, created a real stir, and I want to just read a part of it. You wrote, "The genie of terrorism, chaos, and mayhem has been unleashed onto this country as a result of American mistakes, and it can't be put back in the bottle." Then you go on, "Who did this war exactly benefit? Was it worth it? Are we safer because Saddam is holed up and Al-Qaeda is running around in Iraq? Iraqis say that thanks to America, they get freedom in exchange for insecurity. Guess what? They say they take security over freedom any day, even if it means having a dictator ruler." Do you still feel that way? I mean, I guess, do you still feel that the folks on the street, the people that you know, still feel that way, that this idea that they take security back in a moment?
I think that's the general feeling in Iraq, that security is a very basic need for human beings to live. And, you know, while democracy and having a free government are also important, but they're not as tangible as if you can't really send your child to school because you're afraid that they may die on the way, or that when you go to work, you don't know whether you're going to return home, which is which was the state of things from 2004 to late 2006 in Iraq. I think that I think any Iraqi would take security over chaos. While things have gotten better in Iraq in the past year because of, the troop surge, because of the deals with the Shias and the Sunnis, the overall feeling is that it's still not 100% a normal society.
I guess I was asking this idea that they take security and safety over the theoretical ideas of democracy. You know?
Right. Right. No, I think that's true. I think most people will say that to you. One of the things that that I heard constantly on the ground in Iraq, every time there was a car bomb or shootout or something, they would sarcastically say, "This is the American democracy. This is the democracy they've brought us." Hmm. Because it's very hard to live in that kind of an environment. You know, it's just as oppressive and scary to live in chaos as it is to live under dictatorship, if not more.
Now, that email, of course, intended for family and friends, you stepped sort of outside of your reporter's role. But when it ended up on the blogs, it created quite a stir. Were you surprised by the reaction?
I was very surprised. It was astonishing to see how quickly the email was spread around the world and all the responses that I was getting. You know, as you say, I had kind of written this email candidly, thinking that I was writing to my friends and family. So the objective journalism stand that I usually have in my published pieces was, you know, I was kind of stepping outside of that to say how I feel about the war and what I thought about it. And it really struck a nerve, and I was surprised by that. Partly the surprise came from the fact that many of the things that I said we had all been reporting in our newspaper articles or, you know, magazine articles. And I was surprised that just the personal tone had grabbed the public more. I was also surprised by the reaction. You know, I think it was a very polarized society back then. It was near the 2004 elections. There were people on the left side saying, "Oh, the media censors the truth. You haven't been saying this telling us how bad the Iraq war is. And the people on the right were saying, you know, you're a biased reporter and you're not fit to cover Iraq. So it was quite a storm.
Did the reaction to the email change the way you reported on the war after it went public in any way?
I don't think it changed the way I published pieces or the way that I did my work. I think the newspaper also came out and supported me in a public statement saying that all my published pieces had been objective. So I think that, you know, I had maintained and continued to maintain, professional integrity in all my published pieces. But what I think happened after that email was you saw a lot more pieces coming from journalists there that were first person, that were a little bit more intimate, talking about how the war had affected them or what they saw, which I think kind of the public welcomed or our readers wanted to see.
Mm. Ali is calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Ali.
Hi. Hi, Farna.
Hi.
Assalamu alaikum. Ramadan Kareem.
Thank you. To you too.
Yeah. I'm in the military. I've been in the military for 26 years. My question, I was also involved in the ousting of Saddam Hussein. My question to you is, and I'm also from Yemen, so I have a lot of respect for the Iraqi people. My question is Iraq better today than it was in 2001? Is it better today in 2008 than it was back in 2001?
So is it better today now that Saddam Hussein is gone?
Yes.
What do you think, Farnaz?
I think it depends on how you look at it. I think that you can't make a general sweeping statement saying it's better today than it was in 2001 or if it's worse today. I think that in terms of not having a dictator, it's better. Having an elected government, things are better, but it's not better in terms of infrastructure or in terms of the most important thing, which is security, or having 5 million people, that's almost 16% of the population, who are displaced. I think also that Iraqi society is also polarized about this question. I think if you ask, the Kurds in the north, it's better for them because they're, they're prospering and the fear of Saddam attacking them has disappeared. But, in terms of asking the average ordinary person in the street, I'm not sure what the answer would be.
Mm. Ali, what do you think? I'm curious to how you would answer your own question.
Well, I believe that, I think they're better off because, I mean, there's still some type of violence, and I agree with Farna. You know, the northern part is a lot better off because they had their freedom while Saddam was while he was still a dictator. But I believe, overall, I am glad to see Saddam Hussein to be out of office.
Mm. Okay, Ali. Well, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it. Let's take another call from Sean, who's calling from Franklin, Massachusetts. Hi, Sean.
Oh, hi, Anthony.
What's on your mind?
I was responding to the question as to whether the media gives appropriate coverage to the citizens in Iraq, and I feel that they do not. I mean, if you as an American, and I'm 50 years old, and I'm looking at this whole situation and saying, what's the war really about? And I get the feeling sometimes that Americans think the war is about them more so than about the people who actually live in this country. And my feeling is if the media gave more coverage, I think it would help develop a more balanced perspective.
All right, Sean. Well, thanks for that call. Let's put that idea to Farnaz. Farnaz, what do you think of what Sean says? I mean, my guess is you agree with him, and that's why you wrote this book.
I do. Yeah. I do agree with him. I think that most of the coverage, I mean, I think that we have covered what's happened to the Iraqi people, but if you compare it to how much we've covered the military angle or the story of the troops there and the policy side of it, I think that it's far less. In fact, I think the Pew Center did a poll asking all the journalists, what was the most undercovered aspect of the war, and the story of Iraqi people was got the highest percentage. So it's definitely underrepresented.
Sean, thanks for the call. Farnaz, I want to ask you a little bit about your personal story, because that's a big
sure.
part of this book. You're Iranian-born. You say in the book that you're a Shiite Muslim. I'm just wondering right. how this helped or perhaps hindered your ability to report this story.
I'm actually Iranian by heritage, born in the U.S. And grew up in parts of childhood in Iran and in the U.S. So in many ways, it helped me, I think, in Iraq because, you know, when I spoke to Iraqis as somebody who's from the Middle East and had spent part of my childhood in Iran, had seen the revolution, had seen the war, they felt a kinship to me. They felt that I could understand them better because I had relatives who were still living in Iran, that I visited them, that I knew what it was like to have sanctions, to have, turbulence and mayhem in the country. So in that sense, it was bonding. And I think in a way, also being a woman was very helpful because it gave you access to inside people's homes. Iraqis were a lot more reluctant to invite a male into their home and give them access to the family than they are to women. And I think the fact that my family is Muslim also helped because, you know, I understood the culture, I understood the traditions of the Middle East, and they felt more comfortable with me.
I remember a passage that I was struck by in your book, and I can't remember who the conversation was with, but you were, I think, trying to get information or trying to get access to someone, and he looked at you and said, And he responded this way because you were a woman. He said, you know, what does your husband think about you being out here? And you said, well, I don't have a husband. He's like, well, what does your father think? He said, well, I mean, tell the story because it was very telling about the culture you were reporting in, but also about how you understood it.
Yes, exactly. You know, for many Iraqis, especially, you know, men, when they would see that I'm Middle Eastern, that I'm from a Muslim family and running around by myself in Iraq, it was they couldn't really figure it out. You know, I was having a meeting with Ayatollah Sadr, who's a senior Shia cleric, and he asked me, you know, so what does your husband think of you being in Iraq? And I said, I don't, you know, I'm not married. And he said, well, what does your father think? And I said, well, sadly, my father has passed away. And he said, what about a brother? And I said, I don't have a brother. He said, don't you have any male member in the family who speaks for you? What does your uncle think?
You know? and what was the answer? I mean, it sounds like it's almost you're not legitimate without sort of male sponsorship
here. Right, absolutely. And I just said, you know, I was brought up in America. And he shook his head and said, yes, I can see that. So
I also want to ask you, because of your Iranian heritage, you're the daughter of a family that was caught up in the Iranian Revolution. I'm wondering what it was like for you to cover the Shiite awakening. I mean, it must have had particular resonance for you.
Absolutely.
Because of your background in Iran.
Right. There were a lot of things that reminded me of Iran that I had flashbacks of my the earlier revolutionary days. One of the things that was striking was more like the religious and Islamism within the Shia society that slowly began. You know, there were two Shia clerics that I got to know from the early days after the invasion. And at the beginning, I could go see them in their office and sort of just hang out for a couple of hours and talk. And, you know, slowly they started segregating the office and the women had to go to another building. And the time they were giving women visitors was less. And, you know, you were required to wear a scarf when you visited the Shia political party's offices. So there were little examples like this that reminded me of Iran. And also, you know, right after the invasion, when the army was dismantled, when the police, the Iraqi security forces were dismantled, the clerics, the Shia clerics particularly, really took over. They were organizing neighborhood squads to secure the area, to, you know, looking for looted items and, you know, settling family disputes. So also that also reminded me, had a lot of resonance of Iran after the revolution where, you know, the social network of clerics and revolutionary people was really running the society.
Mm. Let's take another call. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Pensacola, Florida. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello. I have two questions, actually. One, I'd like to know if the family that you wrote about had any kind of special privileges during Saddam's regime of bad party members or had associations with the party. And secondly, prior to the first Gulf War in the early 90s, Baghdad had a reputation for being kind of a a cosmopolitan city, and I was wondering what your...
Well, I think we lost Michael, but I think I know where that question was going. Let's take that one first. Baghdad had the reputation of a cosmopolitan city in the heart of the Arab world. How did it strike you? Was it like that?
Yes. I mean, I hadn't been to Iraq under the Gulf War, but I think when you spoke to Iraqis and when you went around, like, Baghdad has had a very vibrant book market, which was different than most cities in the Middle East. And, you know, a lot of educated people and a lot of writers, a lot of intellectuals. You know, Baghdad, from even the early days of Islam, was famed for a place where writers and artists and, you know, mathematicians gathered. And I think, you know, the many years of the three wars that they had definitely impacted that, and also the sanctions, you know, and that really contributed to the isolation of Iraq by the time the U.S. invasion rolled around.
And Farnaz, Michael also asked about if some of the families you wrote about had connections or relationships to Saddam Hussein's family, or I guess special privileges. Did you cover those kinds of families?
No, I didn't. I didn't know anybody who had any privileges under the Ba'ath regime or that was associated with Saddam or worked for the government in any way. The Nasser family, if he's relating to them, were not associated with Saddam. You know, the family, the husband had a restaurant, and the wife worked at a municipality. So, you know, they were just average middle-class Iraqis.
I was struck, too, in this book, and you describe it very well, and this actually came out in the original email, how you got to this point because of the danger on the ground, where so much of your time had to be devoted to just keeping yourself safe and alive, and that of your translator and driver and the rest of the folks in the bureau. That sounded extremely frustrating. Can you talk a little about that? I mean, how the job sort of changed, I guess.
By 2004, when security had fallen apart in Iraq and when people were randomly getting kidnapped and violence had increased, security took a lot of my time because I was also running the bureau there, you know, so I was responsible for dispatching the Iraqi staff to places or deciding where they go and what we do. And, you know, it was very time consuming. We had to read the reports every time we wanted to go out. We had to make sure, you know, we thought about which road were we going to take and read security reports to say if that road, even for a simple interview or even going out to simply buy groceries, if this road is okay, if this neighborhood is okay. And we had very strict security measures in place, which I think are still there. Have a surveillance car follow you, you know, tell somebody where you're going, what road you're taking, and not stay anywhere more than 20 minutes.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how life in Iraq has changed because of the Iraq War. And joining me is the Wall Street Journal's Deputy Bureau Chief for the Middle East and Africa, Farnaz Fasihi. She covered the Iraq War until December 2005. She's author of the new book, Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. And joining us for the rest of the program as well from Baghdad is Larry Kaplow. He's the Baghdad Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. He's been covering the Iraq War since the very beginning as well. And this is the first time for Cox News Service and for Newsweek. And Larry Kaplow, welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to have you. We wanted to bring you into this conversation just to sort of bring us up to date. We've been hearing about Farnaz's Fasihi's experience. She left more than 2 years ago. What's the sort of word from the ground there? I mean, let's sort of talk about life for ordinary Iraqis. Do you see it improving recently?
I think in objective terms, it's probably very...
Have we lost
Larry? We lost Larry.
Have we lost Larry Kaplow? We'll call Larry Kaplow back. Let me come back to you then, Farnaz.
Sure.
There's a question. You were talking about the efforts that you needed to take to remain safe and to make sure your bureau is safe. And in the book, you talk about how you were affected by the stress of the war. I'm just going to read a bit. You write, "I have lucky boots for military embeds, a lucky scarf for road trips, a lucky handbag, and lucky days of the week. I tap into my gut for right or wrong feelings about such simple things as whether I should go grocery shopping on several occasions I've backed away from interviews and at the last minute, once at the doorstep of the source's house, because my gut suddenly turned against it. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in that. I mean, just how you're a professional journalist. There's a sort of way to do stories, but at a certain point, you have to really trust your gut. And I guess that's what it takes to stay alive covering these stories.
You know, Iraq was unprecedented in terms of the dangers and the risks that journalists take. There was a time in Iraq when I was there where you were literally not safe anywhere, you know, even in the hotel or even at night. You know, our hotel was attacked several times. Every time you went out, you risked getting blown up or getting injured or getting kidnapped when you were at the hotel. So you were in this survival mode and being mentally hyper alert of the dangers around you 24 hours. And, you know, even you don't really sleep very well. You're alert to every movement and every sound. And after a while, it starts affecting you. And I think for me, one of the ways that I think looking back, you know, when I was kind of processing and remembering things, it struck me that I had become a little superstitious because I couldn't control anything else that was going on around me. So I was putting stock in what I could control, what necklace I was wearing and what shoes I was. It didn't make any sense, but it was kind of just one way of my mind to feel like it controlled something. And trusting my gut feeling because I had absolutely no way of knowing what was going to happen if I went to buy milk or if I went to buy an interview. And so if my gut feeling would turn against it, I would just trust that over mm-hmm. conventional wisdom. Mm. So, you know, I think that we all just try to figure out ways that would make us comfortable in that environment, and it wasn't easy.
Mm. Fascinating. I think Larry Kaplow is back. Larry, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Thank you.
Okay, joining
Hi,
us.
Hi, Larry.
That's Larry Kaplow. He's the Baghdad Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. And Larry, before we lost the connection with you, the question was, are things better for ordinary Iraqis?
You know, I think in objective terms, they're largely the same as they were as Farnaz described them in 2005. Water and electricity are huge problems. Still, people are digging wells in their backyards and rigging up all sorts of weird pump systems just to get a little water from the street into their sinks. Electricity is in Baghdad is now maybe 8 hours a day. That's what the State Department is saying, 8 or 9 hours. I think it actually turns out to be less for people in their houses and in practice. But the violence after 2005 really just went off the charts in 2006 and 2007. It was basically anarchic mayhem. People coming in to streets in the middle of broad daylight and in 20 SUVs, sealing off the street, going into an office and kidnapping 20 or 30 people at a time. That has stopped. And as a result, although there are still near daily assassinations and bombings, people have a better outlook about it. They feel like they're coming out of a dark tunnel in that way.
So there's some reason,
still violent.
Yeah, but some reason for optimism. Let's take a couple more calls before the program's over. Greg is calling from Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hello. My question regards the ability now of the Western media to get out in the countryside and range around Iraq now that there is sort of a new stability regionally. Is it now possible for the average Wall Street Journal or Newsweek reporter to go out and find people on the street and get their opinions without as much fear as they had before of violence?
Good question, Greg. Sounds like one for you, Larry Kaplow. Are you able to range about the country a little more freely or around Baghdad?
It's nothing like you would have in a normal foreign posting. It still takes planning and a lot of thought, and you pick your spots, but you can do it. You can go out on this, you can go talk to someone in a store, and instead of just walking out and going to the store next to him, maybe you get in the car and drive a few blocks or a mile away and talk to someone else. We're not at the point where we can sit down in a restaurant and have lunch and speak English safely, as you can do even in Kabul. For example, I went to a grocery store on Saturday. It was the first time I'd gone there in 18 months. I used to go there all the time just because I wanted to buy some of my own groceries and pick some of my own things out. And I did it. I was there for about 15 or 20 minutes kind of sorting through things. And I was being very careful not to speak any English, but I actually ran into an Iraqi who I knew who opened up very loudly and said, "Hello, how do you do?" in English in front of everybody. So it kind of blew my cover. But you can start to do those things, but it's very selective. You have to think about it.
and you have to work at it. It takes a lot of planning.
Mm. Greg, thanks for the call. Farnaz, I was struck in your book how normal, I mean, relatively speaking, life was at a certain point for you before things turned really bad there. I mean, you talked about visiting people in stores and cafes right. and restaurants, and of course that all shut down for you as things spiraled out of control.
I think that first year after the invasion was possibly the most freedom that journalists got in Iraq, even before Saddam. We could literally go anywhere we wanted. I remember just waking up in the morning and deciding I wanted to go to Fallujah or I wanted to go to Samarra without any pre-planning or a security plan and just get in the car and drive. There at the Hamra Hotel, there used to be a lineup of taxis. And when the driver would go home, I would just get in one of the regular taxis or hail a cab in the street and go out and have dinner or visit my friends. That definitely changed by early 2004. And as Larry said, it's gotten better, but it's by no means normal.
Mm-hmm. Let's go take another call. Sophie is calling from Woodbury, Connecticut. Hi, Sophie.
Hi. My sister is in Jordan.
Uh-huh.
And she's staying with an Iraqi family.
Right.
And they are refugees from Kabul.
You mean from Baghdad?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So they're refugees from Iraq, right?
Yeah.
And what's your question?
My question is, are there a lot of refugees in different Middle Eastern countries?
From Iraq, because of the Iraq war. Farnaz Fasihi, help Sophie out here. What do we know about the refugee situation? What's your view on that?
According to the numbers of United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, there are about 4 million Iraqis who have been displaced since the U.S. invasion. There are about 2 million Iraqi refugees in neighboring countries, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, and about 2 million who have been displaced internally inside of Iraq.
So quite a few.
Quite a few.
Yeah, right. Thanks, Sophie, for that question. Farnaz, I want to ask you just a really general question about
sure.
this whole project. And I'm just wondering how your experience writing this book and covering this war altered your view of U.S. foreign policy, or did it? I mean, do you come away thinking differently about sort of, you know, the global play of big powers like the U.S. around the world?
Well, of course, you know, covering a war for many years and kind of seeing how the policy plays out in the streets and among people, I can say that war is not the solution that the U.S. may be looking for. It alienates people, you know, even people like the Nasser's, like the Iraqis that I covered, who were not anti-American, have been turned against America. And I think that's a sentiment that's that you see across the board in the Middle East, that the Iraq war, that kind of the U.S. Invading Iraq or, you know, talking tough has turned many people, even mild people, into extremists.
Mm. Larry Kaplow from Baghdad, do you agree with that? I mean, to the extent that you can find ordinary Iraqis to talk to the extent that it's safe for you to do that kind of reporting, are you hearing the same thing?
Sure. I mean, they are very disillusioned with what happened here, and they're very cynical, but I think, you know, accurate in their assessment that this was done not for them, but for geopolitical purposes for the U.S., and that at the same time Iran is trying to play out their interest in Iraq, and so are the Turks and the Saudis. They very much see themselves as not having control over what happened to them, and they resent it. And, of course, many of them have lost things they'll never get back, like family members and houses.
Mm. Let's take another caller. Nancy is calling from Port Charlotte, Florida. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hello. I was wondering, since you know their point of view and you know our point of view, you have a unique opportunity to tell us what you think might work here. Now, are Muslim nations unable to self-govern themselves? Do they really need a tyrant or a strong man over them? Because we have tried now for 5 years with all of our blood, sweat, tears, our beautiful sons and daughters, and it doesn't seem to be taking there.
Good question. What do you think, Farnaz Fasihi, about Nancy, about Nancy's question?
I think that you cannot impose democracy with wars and guns. It's a process that has to happen internally and slowly in a society for it to stick and work. It has to, you know, the society has to grow to want it. Like you see in Iran, where, you know, there's a serious reform movement where you actually have a lot of students, you know, activists, dissidents who, firmly believe in democracy and the democratic project. In Iraq, we went in and we said, here's, you know, we're going to impose democracy on this country with war, and it doesn't work.
Let's try to get another call in here. Ellen is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I wanted to talk about police versus soldiers, because I sometimes think that the American media doesn't put security issues into terms that Americans can identify with. And I know that by New York City standards, Baghdad would probably need 20,000 police officers. And I had read that they had that pre-invasion, and that post-invasion it was reduced to about 1,800, with the rationale being that, well, there are all these soldiers there who can take care of things. But of course, soldiers don't do police work. And I just wondered, are my numbers accurate, and what do you think of that issue? And I guess my last question is, I keep thinking, if the media had said to the American public, well, what if we let all the criminals out of prison, which I believe Saddam did and people broke out, and then we reduced our police force across the United States to one-tenth of what it had been, what do you think the United States would be like?
Okay, Ellen, let's put that question to Farnaz Fasihi. Farnaz, what do we know about the level of police force pre-invasion and post-invasion?
Well, I think the most important thing to remember is that the United States, after going into Iraq, officially called in an occupation and dismantled all Iraqi security forces, the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police. When you do that, and under international laws of occupation, the occupying force is responsible for policing and securing the country. So the U.S., by declaring itself the occupier of Iraq, had the responsibility to secure Iraq. And also it dismantled all the security forces. So there were no border patrols, there was no police, there was no soldiers, there was no army. And, the Americans, you know, their numbers were not enough to secure the whole of the country and the borders and the streets. And it gave rise to militia, because if you're living in a neighborhood and there's no police, just neighborhood men would pick up guns and start securing the areas. The borders were open, so a lot of the terrorists started flowing in. And I think that's one of the things that even the American military has admitted, that it was a mistake to dismantle and abolish the Iraqi security forces.
Farnaz, how quickly, regarding those mistakes, mistakes like disbanding the army and sending too few troops in to police the streets, how quickly did Iraqis sort of start talking to you about this was a huge mistake by the U.S.? I mean, did they acknowledge it as such right away?
It's interesting to, yes. I mean, one of the things that even struck me when I was going back and rereading my notebooks from those early months, yes, even from the very, very early on, there were people who were saying, look, this isn't right. I shouldn't go into a mosque to have to secure my neighborhood. You know, where's the police? Where are the Americans? Why didn't they stop the looting? Why did they let them loot the museum? Why did they let them loot the banks? So it's something that was very much discussed even from the early days.
And Farnaz, as you look forward from where you're sitting out there in California, and from all this experience you've had, what do you see? How is this going to play out? Answer that any way you want. I'm thinking of, how does the U.S. get out of Iraq? And what does the future hold for this country and all these people that you met in the course of your reporting over there?
That's a difficult. It's a difficult question. It's the U.S. is sort of stuck. I mean, if you can't be there forever, if you get out, I think there's going to be problems and tensions and probably more sectarian violence. But at some point, the Iraqis have to sort it out, I think. But on the other hand, the U.S. also has a responsibility, because it went into this country, invaded Iraq, and so now it has a responsibility to the people of Iraq to make. Maintain some sort of a stability, train the Iraqi forces and the police, and then get out. So it's really uncertain. I think that it can very easily things could unravel and get worse again.
Mm.
I'm curious to see what Larry thinks, who's on the ground, if he's still with us.
Larry, we have literally 10 or 15 seconds left. Give us your final thought from there.
Best-case scenario, a government that's corrupt and abuses human rights, but not as badly as Saddam did, and doesn't do ethnic cleansing, and there's no civil war. Worst-case scenario is kind of a black hole where other countries are coming in and causing problems all the time, and there is ethnic cleansing and constant violence.
Well, I'm afraid on that uncertain and less than optimistic note, we're going to have to end this conversation. Larry Kaplow, thanks for joining us from Baghdad. That's Larry Kaplow. He's Baghdad Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. And Farnaz Fasihi, Deputy Bureau Chief for the Middle East and Africa for the Wall Street Journal. She's author of Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about your book.
Thank you so much for having me, Anthony. Pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks.